Marion Winnick is a name that may be familiar to NPR listeners. She was a commentator on All Things Considered for a number of years and is also the author of several books exploring her experiences in marriage, love, and child rearing. Her latest book is Highs in the Low 50s, that chronicles her foray into dating in the digital age as a middle-aged divorced parent. Marion Winnick joins us from our studios at WGBH in Boston. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Mindy.
So you've made a career writing about yourself. What prompted you to start writing such personal essays?
Well, I started out writing poetry and always had kind of that personal voice. And I've always been fascinated by the things that happened to me. And I don't really feel like it was a choice as much as something that grew out of who I am. I wrote my first personal essay, the first when I was pregnant in my late 20s. And there was something about that whole experience of getting pregnant and having a baby that inspired the particular way I'm telling the stories now.
Yeah. And so when you are publishing such personal accounts and reflections, you open yourself up to both praise and criticism, not just for your writing, but your choices in life. Has that been difficult?
It's gotten easier as I've gotten used to it. When I published the memoir First Comes Love, which is the story of my first marriage and my husband's death from AIDS, there were some really crazy ad hominem attacks by people that just had no interest or sympathy in the kind of people that I and my husband were. And it took some getting used to imagine that people would be so hurtful and vicious and not write about the book, you know, write about you. There were people that said, my children should be taken away from me.
Oh my.
But, you know, the same thing's going on now with I have a piece up on Salon and about 500 comments are up saying that I'm a heartless, terrible materialist, you know, everything bad. And I find that it's more amusing to me now than it used to be. So.
Yeah. And you kind of have to let that roll off your back. You have to have sort of thick skin, right, when you're putting it out there. And I would also think, though, for as many letters you get like that, you also get people who really relate to what you're writing about, who go, wow, you know, that's it. And being able to take some pretty serious, you know, life experiences and finding some humor sometimes in that.
Yes. And that's meant so much to me. And, you know, I've people that are in all kinds of weird situations, from, you know, having an addicted partner to taking care of someone who's dying to just any kind of loss. I mean, I've dealt so much with loss in my work. And that's been and another thing is that I've dealt very openly with making mistakes or doing things I regret in parenting and in other areas where people tend not to want to be vulnerable.
Right.
So it makes people feel better that someone else has done something wrong and isn't afraid to talk about it.
Yeah. Do you get people say, I can't believe you admitted to that?
Yes, I often do.
So many longtime NPR listeners may recognize you as a commentator, as you mentioned, at All Things Considered. How did you find your way to NPR?
Oh, it's a good story. I was living in Austin, Texas. I was working as a tech writer at a computer company, a job that I had for 10 years, writing manuals and really technical stuff. And I had just written that first personal essay that I mentioned to you, which was called How to Get Pregnant in the Modern World. And this was in about 1988. And for the next couple years, I was writing these little funny stories in the Austin paper. And then I got a note from John Burnett, the NPR reporter, who also lived in Austin, whom I didn't know. And he said, you know, I really love these things you're doing in the Chronicle. Why don't you come over to my house? I'll record you and take it up to Washington. And I, of course, you know, picked up the phone the second I got the postcard. And his wife told me that he had just been sent to cover Operation Desert Storm.
Oh, no.
And he was gone for 6 months.
Oh, my.
So I always had a very personal beef against Saddam Hussein. But finally, John returned. And it was the summer of 91. And I recorded my first piece, and then I was doing stuff for All Things Considered for 15 years.
I like to play one of your commentaries from 2006, and it's about helping your mother downsize.
Few tasks lurk more ominously and inevitably in the future than cleaning out one's parents' house after they are gone. But my mother recently decided to save me some of the trouble. A friend of hers had moved to a small apartment from a house lived in for decades, disgorging truckloads of long-forgotten possessions in the process. My mother had been shoving things into her own attic for 46 years. lightening up looked good. She had only to mention this to me, and I sped to our ancestral home in suburban New Jersey to help. Though some might have spent the day sifting dreamily through scrapbooks and wardrobes, my mother and I took a more utilitarian approach. She helped me with the schlepping until a trash bag we were carrying to the curb burst, and the magazines that popped out smacked her in the face and skinned her nose. After that, she just let me do it myself, and I went ruthlessly on, carrying everything to the curb or to the giveaway pile, including a few potentially sentimental items like my father's old Super Bowl party decorations and an art portfolio that belonged to my late brother-in-law. No one has looked at any of this stuff in decades, I told myself. Or, as a friend who just moved her grandmother out of a Florida condo put it, you live, you die, your stuff goes out to the curb. As I knew would happen all along, when I was finally finished, my mother surveyed the heap and called for something to be brought back in. Naturally, it was the heaviest thing of all, some sort of wooden cabinet with built-in drawers that she didn't really recognize but felt was too nice to throw away. She asserted that one of the boys, i.e. her grandsons, would want it someday. I'm going to end up carrying that damn thing out of here again, I said, after I dragged it back upstairs to its dusty corner. Or better yet, I told her, after the funeral, I'll go up to each grandson in turn, placing my hand on his suited shoulder. Noah, I'll say, Nana left something very special just for you. She wanted you to have it. Come upstairs, let me show it to you. As I expected, my mother saw nothing wrong at all with this joke. Black humor is what Nana is leaving just for me. As it happened, my attic cleaning adventure followed weeks after I visited New Orleans, where so many have chosen not to return to their gutted abodes. What is it, after all, that makes a place home? Perhaps some of us are place people whose home is a physical location, and some are things people whose home is created by the objects inside it. If things people have their objects with them, they can feel at home anywhere, and conversely, if they lose their objects, they never will again. I must be a place person, because if a hurricane hits our house in Glen Rock, I've decided to take my laptop, the birth certificates, and a few photo albums. Forget the rest. Thinking back, when I felt incredibly homesick after spending months in Europe, I found I missed the U.S. highway system more than anything else. I just wanted to see an American road. Of course, I was only 20 then, and didn't even have a place to live. All my stuff was in post-college storage in my mother's attic, where it remained for 30 years, until that afternoon a few weeks ago, when it all went into the giveaway pile, or out to the curb.
This essay is an example of how you recount an event in your life in a humorous way that also digs a bit deeper and makes us think about ourselves, even while we're listening to your experience.
Well, I'm sitting here crying because my mom died in 2008.
Yeah.
that house is gone now. So.
Yeah. I'm sorry. And, you know, you talked about that in the prelude. You and your sister, there was a yard sale and how you didn't get there in time to start and so many things went missing.
Yeah, that's another piece.
That was a
piece I had in the New York Times Magazine that was about the estate sale that we had, a very informal estate sale at my mother's house, and this Alexander Calder print that my mother, she had had this like premonition that we were going to somehow not take care of this print. And it was true enough. It was stolen at the estate sale. Mm. Anyway, I'm laughing because we got the homeowner's insurance, so it wasn't as bad as all that.
So you always find this little bit of humor. So, and then another hazard of writing about your life is that your children, your extended family, your friends are subjects. So how does that go over, especially with your children?
There's been mixed response. My youngest daughter, you know, who's 13, has really grown up in, let's say, the age of the Kardashians. Mm-hmm. So she doesn't think it's that weird that everyone in the world, I mean, she thinks it's kind of exciting and cool that we are mini Kardashians, as she thinks of us. And she even has, like, the whole family mapped out to who is which Kardashian and et cetera. My oldest son, and my daughter would tell you this is because I always paint a very flattering portrait of him, has never said anything but I'm very proud of my mother. My younger son, who's 23 now, has gotten very fed up because he's often portrayed, humorously as the quote-unquote grumpy rebel.
Oh,
and about a year ago, he told me to stop writing about him. And so Vince has opted out of the Kardashian saga. And, you know, I've been respectful of it. He has contributed awesomely in the 23 years, and I'm sure I'll get the rights back. But, you know, he's just at an age where he wants to control his public image. And he's one of the, you know, couple million college graduates that are now living in their mother's basements. Mm. And while this may be something that's funny to me to tell funny stories about, it's not that funny,
to him.
So
your latest book deals with being newly single in your 50s and trying your hand at meeting someone through online dating. Did you initially approach online dating as an experiment, or were you hopeful about meeting someone, or was it both?
Well, the online part is really only one chapter because I really bombed out at it.
Yeah.
So, no, the online was fairly short. And then I tried other traditional and less traditional methods. But no, I was dead serious. I wasn't experimenting. You know, I was all about I was divorced and my husband had a new girlfriend and everyone had moved on and I was ready. You know, I wanted to. And I thought it would be easy. That was the funny thing, because I had not been single since I was 23. And, you know, I was married, I was widowed, then I dated someone for 5 years, and then immediately after I met Crispin and got married again. So I never, you know, it had been so long. Right. And I had forgotten how you don't just turn around and the person is standing there. Right. But I sort of had that delusion that I would turn around and the person would be standing there. So many, many unsuitable candidates initially were considered to be, oh, there he is. Right. Yay. And that's what's the problem in highs and the low 50s, is that I really was not exercising much selection process on the front end.
Well, and it's hard because, you know, you've been married so long, or so many years out of the dating scene, so to speak, and things change. It's got to be incredibly scary.
Well, you know, what I can finally have concluded is that at my age group, dating is really different. It's not courtship where you're like spinning these seductive, you know, images of who you are and what you offer. It's like anti-courtship.
Right.
Each person is kind of unpacking this load of baggage and seeing if the other person is going to be able to stand for it. You know, there's very little ability to pretend that you don't have a past and that you don't have, you know, a set of issues that have been well reinforced.
Right.
You know, so it's more about, can you stand this?
Right.
Oh, the magical Prince Charming is here.
Yeah. You know, you have some very funny stories about your dating escapades. And I'm wondering if you have had the ability to see the humor when you were living in these moments, or does that come back when you start to reflect and write about the experience?
Humor is, I think the reason I'm able to do what I do is because humor is such an important defense mechanism for me in times of trial. So, yeah, I do see these things as funny fairly quickly. I mean, not true tragedies, but even the chapter, you know, there's a chapter in here where I'm in the hospital being treated for hepatitis C. I was really sick part of the time that this book covers. And that chapter is one of the funniest chapters in the book. And it was funny to me at the time. So, yeah, I have to say my sense of humor comes with me as far into the dark as it can.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, what do they say? If you don't laugh, you'll cry. You know, some people have that ability.
Sure. Yeah. Or sometimes you'll laugh and cry. That's okay,
right,
too.
Exactly. At one point, while you are lamenting your inability to find a decent date, you are asked to write down the characteristics of your ideal mate. And once you do this, it's noted that you want to date yourself.
Right. Right. That was a sort of chilling moment when I realized that everything I was looking for was just my twin. And actually, that probably wouldn't work out either. You know, and anyway, no one I dated was anything like that, for God's sake. I mean, really, the list is, well, you know, there was a huge range of people that I dated in this book. And on one end, there's a illegal immigrant construction worker who did not speak English or read at all, who was working in my basement, but was very cute. And on the other end was a, you know, neurobiologist with two New York Times bestsellers. So it turned out not to be like any of these factors that you would list that you're looking for or not looking for. I really am past thinking that there's any way to explain what you want.
Right.
What you want is magic.
Right.
And
I was just going to say that chemistry, you don't know when, you never really know when that chemistry is going to happen. That's not something you can predict. You know, that how many times have you been like, boy, I wish I could really feel differently about this guy because he's such a great guy. But you just it's just not there.
That happened a few times in the book where people were really, they were fine. It just wasn't, you know, happening. So I did get some new friends in the course of my dating adventures. We have one, the first guy that I ever met for coffee, you know, from Match.com is still a friend of our family and comes over and watches American Idol with us with his little dog.
Yeah.
And we're like on the fourth season since our date. We've maintained. He brings over his girlfriend that he found on Match.com like 3 years ago, yeah. A yoga teacher. So
I love that in the back of the book, you update, you know, who's doing what now of the folks that you've... And I was noting that. I was like, wow, you made some good friends. You know, you've made a few friends
right.
through that.
But the thing that really surprises people is that I went back and contacted all these mm-hmm. guys and informed them that I was writing this book because, you know, even though that I don't use their real names, I usually use some kind of nickname or, you know, altered name. And I try sometimes to change a couple of details so they won't be super identifiable. You know, I still felt it was a very good idea mm-hmm. to let people know about the book. So I wrote them these emails, you know, hi, you may not remember me, but I'm writing a book about our relationship, you know.
Uh-oh.
And then so I record the responses.
Yeah, and the reaction runs the gamut. Some of them, are, you know, some want you to change some things. So, I mean, the reaction was pretty positive for the most part.
You know, it's a funny thing, but most people think that no one would want to be written about, and what do you know? Most people do want to be written about. Mm. They don't want to be humiliated and criticized.
Right.
But in general, if it's not that, you know, that sort of thing, people like being written about.
Right.
So, yeah.
And they learn something about themselves. I'm. Was it Brett and I can't remember the other one who were both appalled by their behavior.
That was a happy moment for me when he was like, boy, I am a jerk. Yeah, baby, you sure are. And I still don't understand that, Brett. Did you understand? Why?
Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah. So you mentioned this at the same time that you're struggling to meet someone, you become ill a result of living with hepatitis C. But it's a fact of life that as we age, our bodies are not the same as we were 30 years ago. So what have you learned about yourself from dealing with your illness?
Well, I guess I, you know, learned that I was not immortal. I mean, when I started having this illness, I had almost never been sick a day in my life. I've never had the flu. I never caught colds. I never got turista in Mexico. And I really thought that I was some kind of, you know, demigod or something. I mean, I guess I didn't really think it, but I came as close to thinking it as you can and still be sane.
Right.
And so I was, and I knew I had hepatitis C because I was diagnosed with it in the mid-90s, around the time my first husband died of AIDS, and I found out I didn't have AIDS. I found out I did have hepatitis C. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so then another, whatever, 20 years went by. And so I thought, okay, no problem, you know. And then I started to be sick. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the biggest thing I learned is that I am mortal. So that might not be such a surprise to other people, but it was kind of a shock to me. And I think actually everybody has that time, you know, when your youthful sense of invincibility ends.
Yeah, I know.
And I guess I was lucky to have mine last till age 53 or whatever. but it really did end. And, you know, I experienced a lot of things I had never experienced before. I was so anemic, so I couldn't – I'm thought of as a very hyperactive, energetic person with reason.
Right.
And during this time, you know, I was like waking up my daughter for school and saying, you should go out in the street and see if anybody's driving to school that would give you a ride.
Wow.
Because that I really couldn't leave the house a lot of the time. I was really sick.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I learned that, you know – Yep. One can get sick and not have any energy.
Yeah. So despite your illness and the lack of success on the dating front, you end your book by saying you're happier now than you were 3 years ago. Tell us why.
Oh, but you're making me give away the exciting, suspenseful plot of Highs in the Low 50s. Yeah. Okay. Spoilers. It turned out that being single is okay.
Yeah.
I realized that while I had perceived the end of my marriage as an emergency situation, which I should solve right away, you know, after a few years went by, I realized that there was so much in my life that was making me happy, and none of it was going on these stupid dates.
Right.
You know, there was a person I dated very late in the game, and sort of as soon as we walked into the coffee shop, I thought, and I started to give him my little speech. And he said, no, let me tell you what you're going to say. You have wonderful children. You have a big network of friends. You love your extended family. You have a wonderful career and a dog that you love. And that's why you've decided that you'd rather that being single is fine. And I just looked at him and he said, yeah, that's what every woman is saying.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So it does seem to be. Actually, I have a story in the current in the September issue of AARP magazine. That's a reported essay called Single and Loving It, where I'm looking at all these statistics and tons of interviews, and there really are a lot of single people over 50 mm-hmm. who say that they are happy being single.
Yeah.
Sounds counterintuitive, but seems to be the trend.
Yeah, no, and I don't think it ruins the book because you have to read the experiences that you
That's
go
right.
through.
Go there with
to,
me.
Yeah, go there with you, exactly. And yeah. there is that thing, you know, I think we're probably about the same age. I'm in my late 50s as well. And that just that whole aging thing and looking ahead to what's forward. And it does seem, I remember I had an aunt who said life begins at 40. And then when I turned 40, I thought, she's crazy. And then once I turned 50... there's sort of this acceptance that happens. Okay, you're not fighting gravity. You're never going to be that 20-something-year-old again. But there comes this kind of new acceptance of who you are and, I guess, a wisdom, don't you think?
Well, God knows I hope so. yeah. I mean, I think yes. And I think one thing that happens is you get far enough away from youth mm-hmm. that you realize – you're not just like an old young person anymore.
Right.
You know, you're a different kind of person. I feel that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if you have children in their mid-20s or children who are getting married, you know, you're obviously not you aren't the young
right.
people.
Yeah.
You know, another thing like, duh.
But yeah, it took us a while to figure that out.
I guess we boomers were a little slow on the uptake on some of this maturity
exactly.
stuff, you know.
All right. I have to ask you about Crispin. Did he read the book?
Okay.
I know you say he didn't, but...
No,
yeah.
He is. I mean, when he says he doesn't want to read the book, he means he doesn't want to read the book.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I've written the book in a way that I don't say anything bad. I feel mm-hmm. okay about him reading
You're
the book.
You're still friends.
We're friends. We share a daughter and, you know, we have a lot of respect and friendship towards each other. We should never have gotten married. And even though it started off in this blaze of love and glory, it really was a mismatch. And mm-hmm. it was so damaging for both of us. So, I mean, I feel bad. I think Crispin might be a little more blaming towards me than I am towards him.
Mm-hmm.
But he's, you know, he doesn't want to read this book. Like,
yeah.
the last thing he wants to hear about is all this stuff. And I don't blame him, you know.
Yeah.
If he wrote a book like this, though, I would be, you know, trying to steal it off his computer. I mean, I'm a big snoop. I'm always trying to find out everything. I'm to ask the kids, does daddy have a girlfriend now? And I can't help it. I'm a compulsive snoop, but he's not like that. So,
Marin Winnick, her latest book is Highs in the Low 50s, How I Stumbled Through the Joys of Single Living. Thanks so much for being with us, Marin. It's a fun book.
Thank you, Mindy. Thanks for reading it.
And thanks to Alan Mattis and Margaret Carsley for production assistance in Boston. I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.